Event boundaries. Such a comfort to know it's temporary dementia. When I enter a room and forget why I came, to fetch a pen, to write a note, to remember the task my brain's just mislaid. I've only to pass back through the fogging doorway to reclaim a resolution or name. And conversely, a relief to think I won't have to live every future tick and talk of my anxious watch, recalling how distraught I was over anyone's death. I've only to stroll a doorframe's border to forget a particular grief, misbegotten love, or moral lapse to escape the rasp of conscience or self-flagellation, to visit the nations of remembrance or amnesia as I please.
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, welcome to Poets Cafe. Our guest, April Osman, is the author of Event Boundaries and Anxious Music, both from Four Way Books, and has published poetry in numerous journals, including New England Review and Colorado Review. She's the recipient of several awards for her poetry, including a 2013 Vermont Arts Council Creation Grant and a Prairie Schooner Reader's Choice Award. She also has published essays, including Thinking Like an Editor, How to Order Your Poetry Manuscript. She teaches as a poetry editor-in-residence for the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing Program at Sierra Nevada College at Lake Tahoe, and has taught creative writing and literature courses at Lebanon College and at the University of Maine at Farmington. She was executive director of Alice James Books from 2000 to 2008. All the poems read by April Osman are from Event Boundaries, read with permission from Four Way Books, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Welcome to Poets Cafe.
Hi, Lois. Thank you for having me.
Just a short flight from Vermont, right?
Oh, short compared to, I don't know, Hong Kong.
Right. Tell us, so your new wonderful collection on Four Way Books is called Event Boundaries. And what is an event boundary?
So, you know, when you go from a room in the house, say you're in the living room and you go into the kitchen and you can't remember what you intended to do in there.
So, I do that all the time.
Yeah. Well, they have a name for that now, and it's not necessarily senility. So when you go through an exit or an entrance like a doorway, it's a signal to the unconscious to clear the decks for the next event. Mm-hmm. So psychologists have named this an event boundary now, which is not the same as an event horizon, although
right.
Sometimes people confuse them, right, which has to do with black holes and gravity.
Well, there's always that, too. We might yeah. walk into a black hole and never come out.
I do that all the time.
But that's a fascinating idea for a collection. Yeah. And as you were putting your collection together and you got connected with that idea of an event boundary, was that the aha moment when you said, oh, gosh, what a threat, you know, that is the thread for my book?
Actually, no. It happened really late in the process.
Okay.
Titling this book was really hard.
It's a hard task.
Yeah, I had several different titles, and this one I came up with in discussion with my editor and publisher, Martha Rhodes, and, you know, we couldn't land on something, and she finally said, why don't you call it Event Boundary? I said, oh, well, yeah.
How did she come up with that,
though? Well, one of the poems is, right, is Event Boundary.
Oh.
And so, you know, and then so I said, well, it has to be plural, you know, if it's going to be the book title for the book title, Event
right.
Boundaries, because there are lots of them, right? But, you know, I definitely had that in mind sort of, you know, as over some of the period of time that I was writing the book, because when I first read about event boundaries, I read about it in an article in a magazine, and I was just fascinated by the whole concept.
Sure.
And so, you know, I kind of kept thinking about that. So it's kind of there subtly, I think, in some of the poems.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's just a masterful title,
yeah.
because as I contemplate it, I keep seeing event boundaries, you know. You see it within the poems, but you also see it as a metaphor in life.
Yeah.
How these things keep happening, the literal sense,
yeah.
but then how that expands into other relationships, you know, that you have and within the book.
Yeah. Yeah, just a fascinating concept, the idea of, like, you know, going back and forth through the doorway and, you know, remembering and forgetting. And I actually now, when I go into a room and I've forgotten what I intended to do in there, I go back to where I was when I had the idea, and then I remember.
That's what they tell you to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. If that were me, I'd be going back and forth. I went to this room. What was it? Oh, yeah, I was going to go to that room. let's get on to more of your poetry in the book. There's a gorgeous poem called One Night. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
Yeah, and before I read this one, mm-hmm. I'm going to say, just because people are hearing it verbally, and if you see it on the page, it's obvious, but I refer to a one-syllable word at the end of the poem, and the word is night. So,
great.
One night, it may be otherwise, but tonight, I see the fawn in time to slow. I don't kill or maim it visibly, though. My light terrifies the fawn, loping awkwardly along the yellow line, fast as its thin new legs can wobble it, and I witness to suffering too brightly lit, no sign of its mother, just me, godlike and deadly metal, rending silence with my awful horn, my relentless pursuit, just me and the fawn, alone on the merciless road. In the immense darkness, we humans reduce to a syllable, as if we could or should.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, love this poem. I came across this phrase by Gaston Bachelard. I don't know if you know who he is, but he said poetry is instant metaphysics. And, yeah. And that brought me to your book again, the metaphysical aspect of boundaries,
yeah,
and how this poem feels like that. And I had a similar experience where I was with a friend and we came across these fawns. They were actually to the side. There wasn't a horn, it was right there. But there was something about that. There was mist and it was the middle of the night. It was so otherworldly to me. And I just feel like you evoke that in this poem.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a hard poem to write. It's based on an event. I saw this fawn driving one night, and I was so traumatized by it.
The fawn was driving, or you were?
Oh, I was. Like, not knowing what to do, and I wanted to write about it, but it's one of those things that it's really hard to write about and not have it be awful.
Right.
And I tried, and it was awful, you know, and then I forgot about it for a long time, and then I was reading another poet, and suddenly I saw a way in, you know, to write about it, that, you know, an angle that I could do it. And so that's how it finally happened.
But you didn't hurt him.
No.
So that was the grace of it. You know, I mean, it was, of course, you never want to cause that kind of fear in an animal or tension. And I imagine you're out on the country roads at night and that happens.
Yeah. There are a lot of wildlife where I live and a lot of deer. Yeah.
Right.
I actually have a herd of deer in my yard.
So when you were putting this together, and how did you find, as an editor, mm-hmm. and you're looking at things from trying to look at things from an editor's point of view, how do you make the relationships happen when you're putting a collection together? I mean, is it the subject? Is it the tone? What about this poem felt that it belonged in the manuscript? I mean, I can see that it does, but I'm just wondering how you did that as a process.
Well, when I edited my book, I edited it exactly the way that I edit all the poets I work with.
Mm-hmm.
I put myself through the same process.
Okay.
So that, you know, it would help me to be as objective as possible about editing my own work. It was actually really fun. But in terms of inclusion,
could you give us a little hint on what you do when you?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So when I edit a book manuscript, the first thing I do is read all of the poems and, you know, assign them a kind of a grade, check plus, check minus.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kick out all of the check minuses. And then, you know, is the more check pluses, the better, right? But so I keep all the check pluses, assuming that they're apt to the manuscript's major themes or leitmotifs. And and then keep as many of the medium strength, you know, plain checkmark poems as feels warranted by the strength and the possibility for strengthening them and so forth. And then I write down on each of the poems the different themes and subjects and leitmotifs I see, sometimes repeated images
wow,
or
that's
words.
That's very helpful.
Yeah. And then I, then when I've done that for all of the poems that are going to be in the manuscript, then I separate them into piles. Usually it's about five or six, it may be three or four, it just depends. And it's different for different manuscripts, but, you know, one possible way of doing that might be I might separate it into piles based on theme or subject, or I might do it by speaker. So, like, poems that are, you know, mostly just, you know, about the self, and then poems that have maybe self and others, and then poems that are maybe about others or spoken by others. And then I would interweave those throughout the manuscript, connecting the poems one after the other by shared themes or other links, you know, a shared word or an image or mm-hmm. so forth. And I ordered my manuscript, and I do for most, you know, I try to create an arc that suggests some kind of spiritual, emotional evolution so that, you know, you don't end in the same place that you were in existentially as in the beginning of the manuscript.
Absolutely.
Because I feel like for readers, you want to feel like you've arrived somewhere, even if you're still frustrated and confused, at least it's somewhere different.
So it's like a different event boundary.
Yeah.
Gone through a door and and somewhere else. Yeah. That's fantastic. For all of you listeners and especially poets, we're here at Poets Cafe with our wonderful guest, April Osmond. She's a magnificent editor and poet. She was the executive director of Alice James Books for 8 years, and so we're mining some of her jewels here. I know I've had personal experience from and benefited from that, and your acuity and perception. Amazing.
Thank you.
Sure.
I love what I do. I'm so lucky.
That's great. So how about if we go on to another of my favorites here, and hopefully your favorites. I don't know. I'm sure you have favorites in the book. This one.
Sigh. April snow bends each lilac branch, heavy and wet is your body on mine. After lovemaking, but less warm. In truth, a better simile for loss than love, though love appears predicated on loss, or the fear of it. Surely every new love predicts new loss. Branch, you bend more easily than we, but sooner break. This snow's weeping is its vanishing. But the lilac's sigh of relief is not its life. No breath is ours to keep, just as no body is.
Gorgeous. I love the way you can interpret that ending. No breath is ours to keep, just as no body is. So the body can be, it can relate to a relationship.
Yes.
A relationship ends, and you may not be able to have that body next to you anymore. And then, of course, the physical act of loss and dying.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay, good. I'm glad I got that. Yes, and your book touches on those themes of relationships and loss. You've run into some heavy losses in the last 3.5 years, right? Or 4?
Yeah, actually, it's a little longer now since, you know, it was a while before the book was published.
Right.
But when I was writing this book, I had started out, you know, I write a lot about relationships, not exclusively romantic ones, but a lot. And, you know, the first year or two in writing, I thought the book was going to be sort of more of that. And then in the span of a 3.5 year, it span of 3.5 years, my father, my stepfather, and my brother died. And as a writer, you can't not respond to that.
Of course.
So I found myself all of a sudden writing about mortality and, you know, trying to come to terms with that. You know, how do you go on sort of, you know, knowing that, you know, the people you care most about are going to die and that you're going to die? Because when you lose people that you're really close to, I think it tends to bring your own mortality to the fore as
sure.
well. And so, you know, in a lot of the poems, I'm sort of trying to find a way to accept that and live well knowing that. So that was much of the journey.
Yeah. And how one is able to cope with and in particular the way in which the losses happen, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
In the case of your brother,
yeah.
there was a shocking loss.
Yeah, he died of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And he was younger than I was and my only sibling. And
your only sibling.
My only sibling,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
So and he was a late-stage alcoholic. And that's not an uncommon ending, alas, for an alcoholic who doesn't get help. But so, you know, but even though you know that's one of the possibilities, I think you're just never emotionally prepared for it to actually happen. So,
of course not.
Yeah.
Were you close to him or as close as he would allow you to be, let's put it that way?
As close as I could be,
yeah.
given the shape he was in, because he was, you know, in late stages of alcoholism. I couldn't, for my own emotional health, be really close to him because he was drunk all the time. And,
yeah.
you know, trying to talk to someone who's drunk is not real fruitful. So, you know, we were closer when I was younger than we were when I was older, you know, largely as a result of the alcoholism, which just it tends to make relationships fraught.
Yeah. I mean, alcohol has an interesting effect on some people. You know, I'm always amazed at that, at the chemistry that happens there. And then, in the case of people that have that really difficult mix, it's tragic.
Yeah. Yeah, it adds a whole nother layer to process emotionally. You know, I mean, you know, processing a loss, you know, when someone dies is a lot anyway, but the suicide angle adds a lot to the processing, because I think pretty much everyone who loves someone who dies of suicide feels guilty. Like,
of course.
What could I have done? What should I have done? Even if you know, emotionally and intellectually that you couldn't, you know, you still, there's sort of that, you have to wrestle with it.
There's a poem called After.
And before I read this one, I always mention this for anyone listening, but the poem is in conversation with the lyrics to Lynyrd Skynyrd's song Free Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to know that to appreciate the poem, but I think you appreciate it more if you do know the lyrics. So. After oxygen failed to reach his brain, maybe strains of the Lynyrd Skynyrd he loved lofted over the street. Free bird, with no one there to tame or change it. Maybe it annoyed a neighbor weary of hearing its repetition. A finite irritation, last song on the album, and no one left to replay it. Maybe he died in silence he craved more than sound. Soul free of the interfering ego's constant harping, free of what he could not change. None of us could help him. He wouldn't change. No one helped him tie the knots to make the noose. Alcohol changed him in ways not even he could know. Of the last of this man's life, who so loved company, all we know is he died alone, his mind a bird he couldn't change. Can a mind exist without a brain? No dictionary locates it. A bird, always free to fly. Yes, we still remember you. The coroner said the noose stopped oxygen. My brother died alone at the end of his rope.
If you're just tuned in, we're listening to Poets Cafe. Today's guest is April Osman, and she's reading from her remarkable book, Event Boundaries. That's such a powerful poem. Was he aware of your poetry?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I sent him a copy of my first book, Anxious Music, for him and his wife, so.
Oh, he was married. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did he appreciate your poetry? I mean, was he able to relate to it?
It was such a long time ago now. I don't I don't think we had a lot of discussion about it, you know. I think he did appreciate it.
Okay.
I don't know how much he felt like he got it. You know, people, I think non-poets tend to feel sometimes intimidated about poetry, and they think it's a lot more complicated than it is, right? And I think he may have had some of that feeling, like, you know, oh, am I smart enough to understand poetry? And, and I think people, without exception, underestimate their ability to understand poetry. They want to make it more complicated than it is a lot of the time.
Because a lot of it is intuitive, I think.
Yeah, I think, I always think, you know, I tell students early on that when you read a poem, you know, if you're worried you don't understand it, just think about what it makes you feel.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, say what it makes you feel. And generally that's, you know, that's kind of the point.
I used to read poems. I'd call my mother on the phone and read her a poem. And, you know, she had no understanding of of poetry except the aesthetic. And she'd just say, "That's beautiful, honey." I thought, that's all I need. Thanks, Mom.
Approval.
Yeah, you know, she got something there. So I think that's the thing. And now, you know, you're able to honor him with your poems.
Yeah, that actually feels it feels good. I mean, it feels like, in a way, you know, I'm sort of, you know, he's still here in some sense, that his memory is still alive in some sense because he's in the book. And I know after he died, I Googled him.
Wow.
And the only place he existed on the web was his obituary.
Ouch.
And that was, yeah, it was just one of those, like, knife to the heart things. So, you know, having the book sort of mitigates that a little bit.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, I can't imagine losing a sibling, and especially in that way. And in your poem, you know, when that's the thing about writing, you're given the details of it, and then somehow you're able to transform that into art, and so beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah, that I have to say it. I find, you know, writing when I'm struggling with something, you know. And something like, you know, accepting a death, it's cathartic in the sense of, you know, and being able to turn something painful or awful into art, you know, into real art. That feels wonderful.
Right.
I mean, it's a kind of like a transcendence or a triumph in a way, right? And so, you know, it doesn't necessarily heal you in the sense that just going sort of slogging through the process of grieving does. But it I guess it's healing in the sense of just feeling like, yeah, you made something beautiful out of something painful.
Mm-hmm. And you know, art is transformative or can be transformative. And so I imagine other people who've had similar experiences or lost relatives this way, in your readings, that's something you're also sharing with them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually when I read from the book at public readings, I always read some of those poems. And part of that is with the hope that, you know, other people who've had a similar experience, that it'll speak to them in some way. And I know that people sometimes will come up to me after a reading and thank me for reading those.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, I never thought I would be in the club of, you know, people who lost someone to suicide. But now that I am, it's amazing how many people have.
I know.
Shocking.
Yeah, it's shocking, right?
I'll read one more about my brother. It's very short.
Okay.
And this one also has Leonard Skinner in it. My brother loved Leonard Skinner.
Great.
So this one's called Black Comedy for My Brother. In tune with a cell phone's staticky rendering of Leonard Skinner's Freebird, we cast his ashes in the river, lodged in the funeral home's best custom cardboard bowl. But they don't float as they're supposed to. The painted disc plops and sinks like every stone I've ever thrown, in anger or boredom or striving to skip, in short, like every swan dive turned belly flop, every stillborn hope.
Mm. Very powerful. So how about a city like Venice?
Okay. A city like Venice. You love like the boy in the plastic bubble, the movie about a baby born with no immune system, entirely susceptible to injury. The rest of us trust existence, more or less, as we proceed. Unlike the infant, a flu or infected wound won't mean the end for us. They raise him in the bubble to save him for more of the same. He finally bursts those bonds to spend himself, but you're still saving. Your courtly demeanor armors like protective plastic in the airport's too open atrium as you try not to think about what's irking me or might be. I see the built-in gloves his bubble came equipped with, reaching for his parents, pathetic expressions flattened to grotesque by the plastic wall. Their filtered warmth, the closest he comes to embrace. Climbing hand over hand, I have done what none of those airport strangers eyeing your grace and that artificial light will ever do. I've trespassed, finally, your noisome moats, feet-thick walls, and battlements. I have found what they hid, a city like Venice, just barely kept from drowning.
God, I love that finish. Oh, the discovery of Venice. Thank you for being on the show, April. This is host Lois Pien-Jones, and our guest has been April Osman. Thanks to our master chef, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.